Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebelt. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Welcome back. This is the third part of the three-part series on building our own product. I don't want to keep you waiting any longer. If you have not listened to the first two parts, get those now. Don't listen to this episode first. It wouldn't make sense. But if you have, enjoy.
The mass sourcing part, usually from your validation, you'll know what to buy. So the one thing we talked about earlier was like Kickstarters. Right? Kickstarters, say you have 1,000 backers, you can very easily, confidently put in an order of 1,500 because you know you're going to sell 1,000 and the other 500 you can sell on. It also comes down to the margin you price it at on your pre-sale. So usually pre-sale, you might want to give people some discounts, but if you have 50% margin, you know that every one unit you buy, you can sell two, and then kind of, or every unit you sell, you can buy another one, essentially. And it depends on the margin you're working with. But usually 1,500 to 1,000 is when you start enjoying scale. Anything over that depends how much money you have to throw into this.
So do you always go back to the original supplier, or is that the point where you start looking for better deals?
Yeah, you could shop around, but the risk is that if you're shopping around the same city, usually these suppliers know each other and you never know if they have friends in another company. And then that can kind of ruin this thing. Because if they find out that you made a sample with them and you're shopping the price around, they may just cut corners on the actual order because you actually tried to screw them. So it's kind of like a fine balance. So one thing I do is when I need to shop around, I don't do it under my name. I do it under a pseudonym.
Okay.
I actually have a fake account on Alibaba by this guy named John Anderson, and I use a white guy's picture, and he actually does all the talking to the suppliers for me.
That's funny.
I don't use my own face just because I know if I know my supplier, I want to keep that relationship separate, and I don't want them to kind of spread the word about me too. The other thing that this thing does too, it makes your company look bigger, because then you can say, hey, I'm looking to make 1,000 cases. We're looking to do a sample order, but we need our distribution team in the U.S. to kind of confirm this before we can move forward. And kind of this kind of like cloak and dagger stuff a little bit.
Okay.
To make it look, because if you're just the guy like, hey, it's my first product, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, you can probably get screwed a lot too.
Oh, you will. So you're saying even to get the first sample, you use the other profile of someone else that kind of makes the company look bigger?
The way this profile is set up is a Gmail account, a guy named John Anderson, and the signature, you know, his title is Vice President Strategic Sourcing and Procurement, and he has an office in New York in like Park Avenue, somewhere kind of nice, right? So the idea is that to give this image that you're a legit buyer that wants like 1,000 units, and you know, you should be taken serious.
That's pretty slick.
Not just some Joe Schmo who's gonna get started. And like, you can say you're kind of lying, but yeah. So when I'm ready to do that, when I'm ready to actually go to the supplier, I'll be like, hey, by the way, my colleague Terry is the actual guy that will fly there. You know, he's gonna hand off the project from now on. And then I email as myself and then do that.
So how many of these people do you have working in your company?
Two people. It's a two-man shop, but it looks a lot bigger than it is on paper.
No, I mean, how many of these John Andersons do you have working?
I just have one. And the thing is, the Gmail is like a, it sounds like a design studio is the email account. It's like something at gmail.com, and then it's a very generic corporate name.
That's awesome. I'm going to do that too.
Yeah, I can send you some of the responses I got. They're like, wow, you know, how is the weather there? You know, how is your colleague doing?
It's amazing.
You know, we really look forward to it. Are you looking to the U.S.? You know, you're selling in the U.S., Europe, things like that. So it's kind of funny, the responses I'll give you too. Rather than just be like, hey, I'm looking to make a wallet. I don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, just let me know, teach me.
No, I think that's really smart. Once you get the initial shipment in, before that though, do you send them the money directly, or is there some kind of an escrow account that you use?
So there's a couple of different models. Usually they'll take a deposit first, either anywhere from 20 to 50%. And then they'll do the rest of the 50% when they actually ship it to you. So this depends on your relationship too. How well do you know them? I know some people in the DC that we know, they're able to get orders without prepayment just because they've been working with this guy for 10 years. But usually most of them will take some sort of deposit, and you can choose to use escrow or just wire transfer. And some of them do take PayPal too. So
okay.
It kind of depends on the industry you're in. But by far, it's usually deposit of some percentage, and then the rest is when they freight it to you either through air or ocean or whatever other method you choose. And that's a whole different logistics thing that it's another wormhole we can go down.
When you get that first 1,000 in, do you spread out through all the platforms such as eBay, Amazon, Google products, your website, or do you just sell it on your website or just on the platforms? How do you kind of figure out which way you're going to go?
So I sell on my own website. We're going to assume that you figured out customs and everything in the boat, you know, because we could go down too. But
on the customs, you mentioned that before. I didn't even really think about it.
But okay, say you got 1,000 units made. How do you get this to the U.S.? So there's two ways, right? One is by ocean, one is by air. And maybe the third one is teleportation, but we haven't invented that yet too. So right now you're stuck with two ways. So the way I've done it is through air freight, and this depends on how big your product is, how much packaging you are. If it's just like 20 units, it's probably quicker to just send it by FedEx or DHL or whatever. And when you do that, usually the way the supplier, they'll ask you if you want packaging, do you want a box, a bag? The lower you can have it, the better, because there's something called dimensional weight that these air freight guys use, which is basically if you mail a bowling ball versus a giant balloon, the balloon's going to be really expensive too because you're taking up a lot of space even though it's light, but the bowling ball is going to be heavy because it's really dense even though it's smaller, it's weight too. Right? So there's a way they divide the area of the box by the actual weight, and I don't know the exact numbers, but basically that number is how they calculate air freight too. So one of the things, if you're making a product that's small, that's high value, that's a good thing, because if you're making like a necklace that you can sell for, you know, $80, you're making it for 10, airship it, because you can make that up in the margins. Whereas if you're like a friend, Peter Keller, he's making barbells, he's making weights, no way you're going to be air freighting that, buddy. So different products have different ways.
So if it's heavy, you're going to do it by water.
Yeah, so you drive water, this is what they call ocean freight, and usually when you see boats, you see these like kind of big freight containers that are like 40-foot long containers, right? And usually there are two ways to do it. One is called FCL, which is full container load. The other one is called LCL, which is less than container load. And what this means is that basically less than container means that it's like a bus, right? You only have 3 boxes. It's too expensive to air freight, but you don't need a whole container. So you're just going to share a container with someone else going to the same port. So in the U.S., usually you'll go on the West Coast. You could go to New York, but it takes a lot longer to go across the ocean. I think L.A. is the biggest port. SF, Oakland's a big one. San Diego's a big one. So what you'll do is when you do LCL, you'll actually need to wait for a container to fill up before it goes into the boat, because no one's going to ship an empty container with only your box in it. You're going to have to wait for someone else to fill it up, and then it goes. And this could take weeks, it could take days, and it depends on the shipping situation and the export industry. And then from there, you got to do the import, U.S. customs, all this stuff. And ballpark speaking, if you do like 3 boxes, it's going to be like 1,200, ballpark speaking. Like the lowest, you know, ocean freight is usually going to be like 1,000, something like that.
Yeah, I think from the East Coast, you're shipping things to Europe. So that's what my friends did. Like, they would come, buy cars and things, and just bring them back to Europe. But yeah, if you're shipping it to Asia, you got to go on the West Coast.
Yeah, and there's different strategies where you can export through Hong Kong or through China. There's, you know, some different, depending on the tariffs, there's different ways you can work on that. But that's like, we don't need to go into that detail. So basically, you just need to know that you can either ocean or air freight it and to get to the U.S. And that's another kind of hurdle in itself too, because that does cost a lot of money and you need to average that into your final costs down the line.
So how do you figure that out? Do you need someone working for you in the customs to kind of some kind of a person in that business or some contact? Or is this something the supplier is going to take care of? Or
usually the supplier has someone called a freight forwarder, and they take care of that for you in the sense that they've been working together a long time. They're used to getting certain products out of the market. So the reason you have different freight forwarders is because, for example, take something like a battery. Lithium-ion batteries are actually considered hazardous goods, and to get those moving faster through customs versus someone that only does leather, they may not know all the intricate details that goes into kind of import, exporting this product too. So usually a freight forwarder, you can go with the one your supplier recommends, but you can also have a friend, like say in the DC, hey, I've worked with this guy for 10 years in LA, just call him, he'll figure it out for you too. So that does take some research too, because that market isn't very transparent. It's even less transparent than sourcing, actually, just because the business of moving stuff around, like if you don't know what it is, I don't even really know how it works either. But it's about like finding someone that you can trust that has, you know, good referral contacts that can help you move stuff quickly too.
And then only gets it to the airport or to the port itself. So then you still got to get the product to your house.
Exactly. Then you got to have like the U.S. customs. You need, maybe you might need a customs bond. Some situations you might not. I don't really know the details there, but you got to get it from there into a truck that then goes to your warehouse or to your living room or to like a fulfillment center that can then just kind of mail the products to you too. So the best practice is usually to have your product package at the supplier end site, because the last thing you want to do is to like say, hey, I have 1,000 units that need to be shipped to the US, and then you got to find a supplier to package them again. Either it's yourself, your friends, or you have someone else do it. It's just the extra cost that you should just build into the front end when you get everything made.
Yeah, we haven't really mentioned anything about packaging yet.
And the thing is, like, if you're making like furniture, obviously you can't package that, right? There's different, whereas like a wallet, you can just use a, you know, a bag, a box, you're good to go. If you're making like furniture or like, you know, basketballs, usually you won't even inflate them too, right? That's another angle too.
I don't know, man. The furniture, I think IKEA would prove you wrong.
That's true, yeah. But if you're making like some other stuff, like a nice leather chair or something like that.
Also, IKEA would prove you wrong on that
one. Yeah, that's true, exactly. But the point is that packaging is a whole other thing that you got to think about when you make stuff too, because that affects your shipping costs, and it affects the shipping costs not just from the supplier to your warehouse, but also from your warehouse to the end customer too. And that affects if you want to get free shipping, or can you even do that, and what do you do, flat rate shipping or like percentage of order size or all that stuff too. And then how much margin does that affect you all the way goes down to the bottom line in the end too. So a lot of stuff to think about. If there's an issue, like ship, like making stuff is one side, shipping and packaging is another equation too. That's kind of...
Yeah, so where in this whole adventure do we start thinking about packaging? Which step would packaging be done?
I'd say packaging would be done once you have the sample done. Because package design, there are certain ways to design a package that maybe like Apple packaging, I have like a guy that has... that tests like 500 boxes apparently, and all he does all day is just open the boxes, because there's a experience that comes with that. I mean, not everyone's going to be at that level. I don't think everyone's going to be at that level, but certainly, you know, what do you want? Do you want people to get this in like a nice box or just a bag or even like a cheap plastic thing? And then it depends on your product. Are you targeting the high-end market, middle market, low-end market, hipster market, things like that? And which goes back to kind of the validation angle, where, you know, are strangers giving you money, and then can you figure out that profile to build that into your packaging and your whole brand of this product?
But would I need to find a new supplier for the packages, or would my current supplier know who to work with, or would they do it themselves?
Usually the supplier will have a packager that they work with that could get you better rates. In some cases, you may want to do it yourself. If you want to add some custom stuff, you can just send it to the supplier like, hey, here are some stickers, or here's like a thank you card I want to include in everyone, and then they'll just do it for you in some ways. And they'll just come together with the package. But the other thing is too, if you're doing this, there's a little bit of extra shipping costs, and maybe it might make more sense to just make it there, get some basic packaging, and then get it to the US. And then that'll depend on your product too.
So let's say I got this product in my warehouse or living room or garage, whatever. Yeah. I got the 1,000 in. There are different platforms I can sell them on. So I can sell them on Amazon. I can sell them on Google products, eBay, Etsy, depends, you know, whatever there is. My website. Which ones do you sell things on? How do you figure out which ones you should sell them on?
Yeah, so each market kind of has its own demographics. So Etsy is like these handmade guys that kind of make it in the garage. And it's shifted over the years where it was just like some girl, you know, in her art studio making 10 of these, selling it on Etsy, to where a lot of people are just private selling their stuff there. And it's looked down upon on Etsy because you shouldn't be mass manufacturing and saying that you made it in your garage, even though you may be the designer, but it goes against the spirit of that. And a lot of the, you know, the platform has been criticized a lot on kind of that. And you know, most people wouldn't sell on Etsy unless you're making it yourself in your garage. So the next one is probably Amazon. Amazon, just because it's such a big marketplace that even if you put something on there, someone's probably going to buy it. The only thing is with Amazon, if you're going to do it, which is one mistake I didn't do, is you should do FBA. And FBA means that basically, like I said earlier, you send the product to the warehouse. And the only thing is, Amazon has a very specific requirement on how they want the products to be received. But you need to enter all the listing details. There's a certain packaging requirement they have in order to do FBA. And if you don't, they ding you for all this stuff. And the good thing is that once you're in there, they do the shipping for you and you get better shipping rates and you get to sell to Amazon Prime guys too. So Amazon, just really quick gloss over that. And then the next one, eBay. eBay, I don't really know much, but most people sell used stuff on eBay. So I mean, it's like 2015. eBay's heyday really was like 2000 to 2005-ish. So
you would think so. You would think so. But I just had a guest, yeah. John Lawson.
Yeah. Really? Wow. I'm probably wrong then. I stand corrected.
Well, it's just, you know, that's why I wanted to mention it. So, and but what he's done too,
yeah,
is he has now another person in South Korea who he's hiring, yeah, that is speaking directly with the Chinese supplier and checking the quality of it before it even gets to him, because he's had a lot of issues with it.
Yeah, so he was basically reselling first, or?
Well, he's been sourcing stuff from China and getting it himself in the States.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of issues with quality, right? Different types of issues, and maybe the amounts didn't match because, you know, it was a small product. So now he's got an intermediate type of a person in South Korea that's doing all the checking for him, the quality control before it gets all the way to the States.
Well, you should test all platforms too. Some might hit, some might not. And maybe eBay hits for him, but it doesn't hit for someone else. Maybe whatever. They should always test it too, so don't take my word for that.
So what's the next one? Google products. What do you know about that one?
Yeah, Google products is basically just an XML feed of your product listing, and then you kind of bid for that in a CPC style type thing. So it's like kind of like AdWords, but you have images, and they call it Google Shopping too. So I think Brendan Tully's a really big fan of this. I tried it a little bit, but it didn't really hit much, because if you're like doing your own branded stuff, no one's really searching for that yet, especially as a new brand. So Unless you're selling like more generic stuff, it's kind of harder to target. And I think I was talking to some other owners too, where we kind of have our own brand and we tried Google Shopping, just nothing was hitting, so we just all stopped it too. But you know, maybe someone else can do it better than us, and it's just a better product that's fit for them too. So a lot of people arbitrage this, where I think, say they're doing drop shipping, where say, you know, you're looking for a very specific model number, like a SKU or like a brand where it's already made by someone else. There's kind of brand recognition. And then you target the Google Shopping there, you can kind of get some traffic there too. So like, gotta test it.
Do you think there's anything we're missing that we haven't went over going from the prototype to the selling itself?
Yeah, I think one thing to also look over is if you can get some samples made and give it to people to test out, whether it's bloggers to get some PR on that, or just kind of influencers, I think that's something you should invest time into, especially if you can have the money and the time and resources to kind of put this initial order in before you go like 1,000, 2,000 plus, because then that'll give you kind of a more momentum to do it as you launch too. And I understand not everyone's in this situation, because you can't always just put in an order for 100 units, mail them to a bunch of people, and get it started too. But if you can do that, it'd certainly be a big leg up for when you do the launch.
How much money should someone have in their pocket before messing around with physical products? And let's just say it's a smaller product, and we're not going into any electronics or anything fancy.
Also, if you're doing like a handbag type of thing, minimum 1,000, 2.5 is probably the best. Just because what happens is the first sample, you'll pay a retail price. They'll probably FedEx it to you, because you're not going to want to wait 2 weeks in the regular mail. And then you need to go through like two or maybe, you know, four or five samples, depending on what the final product is and how well you conceived it. And timeline, I'd give it like 6 months to up to a year, probably. It depends how fast you move and how fast the supplier moves. Because when you work with a supplier, you're not their only customer, even though this might be the only thing you're working on. And a lot of it depends on their workflow, how busy they are, how, you know, can they put you in the pipeline, and kind of how well you can leverage yourself to get in that pipeline in some ways too.
How much faster can you move this if you go to China yourself in person?
You probably do it within, I'd say, 2 months. If you can afford to fly there and live there for like 2 to 4 months, you could definitely hack this out really quickly.
Okay.
Because a lot of the time is spent emailing them, waiting for the time zone to come back, waiting for them to check with the designers or whatever, the factory guys, and then FedExing it to you, you playing with it for a week, giving your feedback, and then to make another sample, and then doing this like two or three more times before you finally put in the order. And there's also like holidays there sometimes, like October is a big holiday. There's also February, Chinese New Year, you know, Tet, Chinese New Year, whatever they call it. It's a big holiday where they literally shut down for like a whole month. So when you're making stuff, you got to be wary of these kind of holidays where you're overlapping into these big things. Because in China, these holidays are like 2-3 weeks at a time, because it's so big that they need to give workers like 2 or 3 days to get home to enjoy the holidays, and then 2 or 3 days to come back to the factory. And it's a huge operation for everyone there.
Wow, and we're showing how, you know, Chinese workers are mistreated and can't get any days off. And, you know, look at them having all this time off.
Well, like these holidays, like you gotta understand, like Chinese New Year is like Christmas for Westerners, essentially.
In the US, most people have to work on Christmas after corp, at least in the morning.
Exactly.
So yeah, you don't even get a day off, man. This is like, you know, slavery. You went to China. So you went to one of these cities. How much do you need per month to survive in one of them? If you're trying to, you know, hack through this, just how much do you need?
The thing is, so I only was there for a week, but you can live, I guess it depends how far your supplier is from the main city. So if you're in Shanghai or Beijing, those are really expensive cities to live in. And chances are no one's going to be making stuff in the city. They're usually like a couple miles out there, somewhere in the middle of nowhere, probably in a shitty neighborhood. The good thing is that it's probably cheap to live there, but the bad side is it's going to be a really kind of shitty lifestyle when you start out there too. But, you know, the price is you're paying for the advantage of being able to go to the supplier's office or factory, have a quicker turnaround so that you're not spending 4 months going back and forth on this thing that could have just taken 1 month or maybe even like 2 weeks.
Yeah, but give me a ballpark. If I want to stay in the city and I'm just going to travel out to the supplier, like how much do I need for a month to fairly comfortably live in that city while I'm doing what I got to do?
I'd say rural China is 2015. I think like 2K a month is doable there.
Yeah, but I don't want to stay in a shitty neighborhood and buy the supplier. I want to be in the city and just drive out to the supplier. So how much is the city going to cost me?
Well, it depends on the city. So I was in Guangzhou, probably 2K. You could do 2K there, just living in a kind of decent place. Now, if you're like in the middle of the boonies, like in the desert, somewhere near Mongolia, I have no idea because that's I've never been.
It's probably like $300 as long as you milk the cow in the morning.
Yeah, probably. You sleep with the goat, you know, sleep on its belly and things like that.
No, you just got a part of the, you know, the duties of the household. I mean, yours is probably going to be like milking the goat or something. And you just, you know, you're like part of the family.
I mean, the easiest thing, there's probably listings on Airbnb you can go to. That's what I did when I went there. In worst case, if you're super budget, you know, try your luck with couch surfing if you're on a super budget.
Yeah, because I was thinking Airbnb, but then food and, you know, like the extra stuff, just how much overall. So you say 2K would be enough for a person to kind of hack
it. Yeah, and you're not going to like ball out. You're just going to kind of like be able to hack it. And, you know, like there's stories where people, they live at the factory. I'm like, oh, I don't want to go down to that low. Like I heard a guy at Shark Tank, he moved to China for 4 months and he slept on the factory floor because he wanted to save money. And I was like, wow, that's pretty hardcore. I don't know if I'd be willing to sleep on the factory floor. That's pretty crazy.
That is a pretty hardcore story. All right, Terry, if people want to find you and contact you, where should they go?
Yeah, you should go to buildmyonlinestore.com, or if you want to check out one of my stores, ballerleather.com. We sell wallets that we talked about on the site there.
Well, this was it. I want to thank Terry Lin again for coming on, because we pretty much raped his brain right here. I mean, this is all he knows. So thanks again, Terry Lin. And for everyone else, see you back next week.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect Liebel. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.